Thank you, Sylvia. Please join me in welcoming our speaker tonight, Marilyn S. from Pacific Group in California.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Slater, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am really thrilled to be up here. This is a group that I have come to love, and any time I can spend here is really happy. I'm grateful to Joe for the invitation to participate in this meeting, and also for coming to pick me up at the airport this morning, and taking good care of me all day, in fact. Between Los Angeles and Portland, or the place where I'm staying, I managed to lose my watch, my cell phone, and my credit card. And Joe was calm and smiling. Lose your credit card? You can use mine. Lose your cell phone? I have an extra one. Here, you can use mine. And this is an example that if you are active in the program and stay sober for a long time like Joe, you will be in a situation like that and you can smile and act gracious and not have to say, you stupid moron, how could you be so careless? And that would have hurt my feelings. So, what brings me here? A lot of alcohol, actually. But it's funny how it kind of sneaked up on me. I did not have a drinking problem, I thought, until well into Alcoholics Anonymous, after I'd been here for a while. So you would say, well, why in the world did you go to Alcoholics Anonymous if drinking was not a problem for you? Well, other people thought I had a drinking problem. That's why, and I am very subject to peer pressure. And I had no idea why they were suggesting such an absurd thing, but it could be the thing that caused them to harbor such a possibility was that I was no longer doing anything but drinking and had lost my job because of drinking. And that could have been the clue, but certainly alcohol seemed like a friend to me. But here I was in this strange fellowship, knowing that I didn't really belong. And yet, something strange happened as I was just passing as an alcoholic. I was asked to give a 10-minute talk after I'd been on the program for a month or two. And I was in this big active group. We had a home group that met on Tuesday night. It was like this group, but smaller at that time, the good old Pacific group in Los Angeles. And so my sponsor's husband was standing in a secretary, and as I came in the door, he said, would you be a 10-minute speaker tonight? And I laughed and said, no. I don't have anything to say, and I'm fairly new. And he just nodded, sort of calmly like Joe, and smiled and said, before you make up your mind, why don't you go talk with your sponsor? Well, I was more than happy to do that because I knew that by this time my sponsor loved me more than anything else in the world and would protect me from harm. And so I said, Marion, Byron asked me to talk, and I can't talk at this meeting. I mean, it's way too big, and I'm new. And much to my surprise, she looked disappointed. And then she said, oh, Marilyn, that's an AA request. We always say yes to AA requests. I suggest that you go back to the door and you say to Byron, thank you for asking me to participate in my own sobriety. I regard it as a privilege. I would be happy to do it. And I hadn't heard much, but I heard, what an order, I can't go through with it. And that was singing in my mind. But wanting to please Marian by this time ever so much, I went back and I said those words and I got signed up to give a 10-minute talk, my first time at the podium. And I felt, well, what an order, I can't go through with it. But as I sat there, watching the preliminary events, not listening to Chapter 5, of course, not paying much attention to anything except what in the world am I going to say, I made a decision, and that was I was going to be rigorously honest, maybe for the first time in my life, because I had never been honest. I really, really wanted you to like me a whole lot. So I went through life thinking, who do you want me to be today? What kind of a dance can I do to get you to smile and like me a whole lot? And I was at a meeting down in Southern California, and a person that speaks a lot down there, Evan D., was at the podium, and he said, my higher power for many years was the look on your face. And I thought, yeah, yep, I was just going through life like that. But I had heard a few things, and rigorous honesty was one of those things. So I thought, I'm going to let it all hang out. I'm going to bare my soul. And I got to the podium. And indeed, I did that. I talked about growing up in Ohio and being misunderstood, a lot of bad breaks and misunderstandings. And I just really was not treated in the way that I wanted to be treated and expected to be. And this caused me a lot of anxiety. And after years went by, it bubbled over into existential angst. And I searched for meaning. And I went away to study science because I thought there would be answers there. And that convinced me of something that I had suspected in Ohio, that there is no spiritual basis to the universe. There were a lot of churches and God-fearing folk in Ohio, and I thought all of that was silly. And I had decided, especially with the help of studying science, that God is like those other supernatural beings, and I just put God into the category with the Easter Bunny, Count Dracula, and so I talked about that. I think that I even went on to add that any program based on spiritual principles is bound to fail. And now and then I return to existential angst. So I got a sign from a person, sit down, time. But I thought, I've got to wind up on a profound note. So I tried to summon all of these things that had meaning. And I said, what have the years taught? They have taught me that the universe is one big, hideous wind-up toy. Thank you very much, and sat down. And there was the mild, because this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and we care. And you can get up to the podium and do just about anything, and they'll go. After the meeting, I ran over to Marian and said, how did I do? How did I do? And she said, it was good that you said yes to AA. That was good. Uh-huh. But Marilyn, you're going to have to start mentioning that you drank. And I was absolutely stunned because that had so little relevance to the pain that I felt and the drama in my life and the bad breaks and misunderstandings, the things that had caused me such pain and agony. And yet, by this time, I had fiercely attached to Marian because I was basically a sick and hideous parasite. And I would attach to anything that came by, any kind of warm mammal. And and I had firmly attached to Marion, and I desperately wanted her approval. And so it seemed to be something that I couldn't understand, but she said, talk about your alcoholism. And I began to do that to people who didn't even want to hear about it, but I wanted to please Marion. And if I was called to participate, I talked about drinking. And lo and behold, I began to see a pattern that I had never seen before. I began to see that I had felt that life is pretty miserable. Early on, I had concluded what bumper stickers used to say. There used to be one that was kind of common, that life is hard, and then you die. But I had grown to know that that was far too optimistic. By that time, I felt life is hard, and it just goes on and on and on and on and on and on. So I began to see that there seemed to be no end to my dis-ease, my discomfort. Although I tried many things, I went away to study science. I thought that was going to be the big answer. If there is any answer in this universe, it's the elegant laws of physics and chemistry and biology. And there are some very nice laws, and it drew me in. And it also was beginning to give me a common language. I thought that if I could really study this thing, I could meet up with other scientists, and I'd finally be able to talk to somebody. And lo and behold, along the way, I got a job in a lab, went off to Chicago to study, and to get this job, there was a person who gave me a test to see if I could work in the lab, and he was a real scientist. And I could tell because he had a white lab coat. And he had a slide rule in his pocket. Now, a lot of you are young. A slide rule is an old-fashioned calculator, it's unbelievable how things have changed. Well, I'm very old. But anyway, I saw this lab coat and slide rule, and it just spelled science for me. Just dazzled by it, and I wanted to grab and fondle his slide rule. I got the job. So I was in this real science lab and was getting acquainted with Bill, the scientist. And there were other scientists there, too. And Bill went away to a meeting, and he sent me a postcard. And he said, "Dear Marilyn, I thought about what you were saying, and all I can come up with is..." And he wrote out an elegant partial differential equation. And no man had ever talked to me like that before. And then one day he said, "Do you want to get married?" And I said, "Yes, yes." And we went off to Ohio, where his dad was a Lutheran minister of all things. And I'd been raised by atheists, and here we were in this little religious ceremony, and it was quaint, and his dad was saying things like better, worse, sick, healthy, death do you part, love, cherish. And Bill said something like, "I do." And he was signing a big contract and was aware of that. And he had no idea at the time what he was agreeing to, I can tell you that. But he's a man of his word, believes in keeping commitments. I heard those same words, and I said, "Yes, yes, I do." But what I meant was, now I can attach to you like a tick on a dog and suck out your life. And proceeded to do just that. And as you can well imagine, my marriage was disappointing because Bill just could not fulfill my every whim and desire 24 hours a day. And one more thing had let me down, so I was going through life really, really sad. And And there was just absolutely no relief from that. We went to California, and I began working in my very own lab, and I had my lab bench and a set of test tubes, and I began to mix things together, and things began to explode, and my work was not going well. And I think that I just really don't know what I would have done about that, because I was just getting to that place that no alcoholic or really any person should get to. I mean, there are terrible things that can happen to us, and one of those things is not getting just what I always wanted, which was the story of my life. You just couldn't anticipate my every need and give me just what I always wanted, so I was always pretty upset about that. But I found that a more hideous curse was getting just what I always wanted and finding, no, that's not it after all. Because then there was no hope after that. And I had found science, and that wasn't the answer. And the thing that that saved me was the second most important thing that's ever happened to me. The first thing, of course, the first most important thing is Alcoholics Anonymous, without any doubt at all. But the second most important thing was that we entered the 60s. And everything that that brought with it. And again, if you're young and you missed it, I feel sorry for you. It's a time for people like us. Here I was in this lab, and we would put in a hard hour of work. And then we'd march up on campus and try to close down the university. And I had no idea why we were doing that, but it was fun. I enjoyed it. I had stored up a lot of anger by that time, and I just wanted to close things down and scream awful things at people. And I enjoyed group anger. Good. And then we'd retire to the lab and drink some lab alcohol, and there was a guy there, Brian, actually, that was mixing things up furiously at his lab bench. He would always encourage us to sample some. It was a derivative of lysergic acid, later called acid. He'd say, try some. We're going to a seminar, and it's going to bring out all the color in the slides. And then we'd leave the lab and go out to these wonderful bars. I didn't know such things existed. They probably even existed in Ohio, and I never knew that. And now there were these strange and wonderful places. There was one, the Matador, where people jumped up on the table and danced with castanets and served Black Russians. And I just felt like, this is international travel. And then something clicked, and I thought, you know, it just took a while. There was a delay, but I knew that science was going to bring me to this happy place where everything fell into place, where I, for the first time, felt like I can talk with other people. I have companions. I have a sense of purpose. I'm a real scientist, and life is wonderful, wonderful. I didn't know, I couldn't put that feeling into words until well into Alcoholics Anonymous when I came to our promises. And I just realized that when I drank, all of those promises came true really fast. And that was fun. We'd often then take a drive, maybe go down to the ocean. I was down there in November. It's kind of cool in L.A. in November, and I decided it might be fun to swim to Catalina. And luckily, my mates on that trip had not been drinking as much as I had, and they formed a human chain and went out and dragged me back. But these were the good days. And it was so good that I just realized that this is the answer to everything. And my work was not going well. And so I helped it out by bringing a lot of beer into the lab. By that time, beer was my favorite drink. and I had to move into a big refrigerator to be near my beloved beer. Somehow, even though it was the 60s, I just couldn't pile up all those cases on my desk in the public university. And so I moved it into a big refrigerated room and just changed the nature of my project. I was working on proteins of muscle proteins, and I changed it to muscle proteins at low temperatures. And moved into the refrigerator. And I would probably be sitting there now had not, after a couple of years, the director came up to me and said, "Marilyn, you've been in that refrigerator quite a while. It's about time to write up what you've been doing." Now, you probably concluded this, but I probably should mention it, that I was supported by public funds. National Institutes of Health gives grants to promising scientists because they do research and they develop things that help medicine and push back the frontier of science. And so it's a wonderful system. And I was just sitting there drinking beer and accepting public funds, not thinking anything about it, squandering the funds, and not even paying a price for it at that time, because I had my beloved beer, and I just sat there. But the director was no doubt watching those funds and thinking, "I'm going to have to account to NIH for these people in my lab, so I'm going to find out what this person has been doing." And I did not have an answer for him that day. I just went home and sat on my couch for about 3 months, as I recall, and I still couldn't think of what I'd been doing there. And that's when I mailed back the keys, and that seemed to be the end of my career. I should have gone to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would not have known that had Marion not said, "You should talk about your drinking." And I began to see, my gosh, there is a pattern here. By that time, I was pretty much a full-blown alcoholic. I had to have alcohol just to get through the day. Life had become so painful. And I had drunk my way out of a career that I thought that was going to be the thing I'd always wanted, that I would do all of my life. And now it was all gone. And yet it never occurred to me that alcohol had anything to do with it. I just thought, boy, I had a lot of bad breaks there. And I've been treated badly by life, misunderstood. The trouble didn't stop. I realized that our house was filling up with small children, and they were clearly mine. And I did not know how that was happening, and I could not seem to stop it. I fled to the garage quite often to gather my wits about me and drink a lot of beer so I could go in and be a good mom. Realized when I came into the house to be a good mom that there was a very large one there who turned out to be my mother-in-law. She had been there for quite a while. Taking care of things, I resented her a whole lot for obvious reasons. She was doing what I couldn't do. I was thinking, why doesn't she go home? She has usurped my position here. And yet the children were in terrible danger had she not come. But I couldn't see that. I drank enough beer so that I forgot that sometimes I would come out of a blackout and I would be driving around in a car looking for that grocery store where I could get Alps beer for $2.98 a case in those days. And I would come out of a blackout and there would be little children in the back seat. And in those days, we didn't wear seat belts and there were no car seats and they would be kind of crawling around. I would just kind of pull over to the curb, because that's how I got from place to place. I could feel the curb hitting the tire, and I kind of knew where I was. And there were real challenges, because I would do that, and then I would see a parked car in front of me and have to move out. And I'd think, now, let's see, how do I turn this wheel to get around this car? Those were my major problems in those days. I'd also come to sometimes even in bed, 3 o'clock in the morning, and think, you know, I was giving the children a bath. Where are they? Did I turn off the bath water? And I'd run and look in the bathtub, and it would be empty, and there would be little children in their beds. And I would think, okay, we're safe tonight, but, you know, I'm just going to have to get organized, and I'm going to have to stop living this way. Something is terribly wrong here. And then I'd hear my mother-in-law saying things like, Marilyn, unless you get control of your life and stop drinking so much, we're going to see that you get locked up and you'll never see the children again. And I just thought, that witch, or actually something that rhymes with it, how can she talk to me like that? I mean, right here in my own garage. And but it's largely because of my mother and my mother-in-law, these alternation of grandmas that came to take care of the children, that came to maintain order there, that did the laundry, that did those things that I should have been doing, that I was shamed into Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't even like any of these adults. They didn't understand me and my pain and my need to drink so much. And they talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And even though I didn't like them, I still wanted their approval. I wanted them to like me. I wanted them to stop saying those terrible, cruel things to me. So I began to visit Alcoholics Anonymous. I came first to the program in 1969, and I had all the requirements for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous except a desire to stop drinking. So I did what our literature suggests. When you have doubt about your drinking, try some controlled drinking. I didn't do it consciously. I just made little rules for myself. I'm not really an alcoholic, even though people think I ought to go to that fellowship. But just in case, I'm just going to make rules. I'll only drink 2 cans of beer a day. And that always worked, so I could up it to a six-pack. And then I'd lose count, and I'd come out of a blackout. And I think, now, there was something wrong with that rule. We're going to modify it. And I certainly had the illusion in those years that I can control and enjoy my drinking, because I remembered those times that I could, and then I lapsed into a blackout and I forgot about those times that I couldn't. It's easy for me to understand why most of us die of alcoholism. The New York office says that 50% of alcoholics who come to Alcoholics Anonymous and sincerely try to work this program, take the steps, get a sponsor, stay active, 50% of us die drunk. And that's shocking and horrible. And yet it's the highest recovery rate in the world for any kind of a program on earth. So we're lucky. There's a 50-50 chance that we will be the lucky ones. And I think our odds go up if we're in big, active groups with a strong sponsorship ethic like this group, like my home group, the Pacific Group. And yet it is so, as our literature says, cunning, baffling, and powerful. While I was drinking, even after I had come to the program and was trying my controlled drinking, I had this thought that if it ever gets bad enough, I can go to that crazy program with all those fanatics. But thank goodness it's not that bad. At that time, I was turning all greenish-orange and my hair was falling out. And I was doing nothing but drinking most of the time in my garage, and felt sick all the time. But I thought, if it ever gets bad enough, I can go to that program. So what in the world got me to come to Alcoholics Anonymous besides the grandmas, my mother and my mother-in-law? Well, I used to call central office. I liked to argue with those people. That was my social life. And And mostly they'd just say, well, we've got to get off the phone and help the alcoholic who's still suffering. Now, are you sure you don't drink? And I said, no, I don't drink, but I have a friend. And of course they would say, have your friend call. And I would say, no, my friend doesn't have any hands. And so don't go. Stay on the phone. Stay on the phone. And they'd get off all too soon. But one morning I called for social life, and this was a strange one. She kept talking to me. She engaged me in a conversation, and she learned my name, and she said, now, Marilyn, she kept calling me, now, Marilyn, tell me, do you have a drinking problem? I said, oh, no. Do you drink? No, no, no. Well, did you drink today? And that was making me nervous. And I said, no, no, I don't drink. And she said, well, when was your last drink? And I started thinking, I got to go now. I've got to get off the phone. But she was saying, no, don't go, don't go. And the tables were turning in a worrisome way. Before long, she had learned my address. So if you're new and you want to continue drinking, don't give them your address. She sent someone to get me, paid a 12-step call, and the wonderful Lorena came, and she said she would take me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and she took me back to the fellowship, and that made a lot of difference. I wanted to tell her my requirements. Don't take me to the Pacific group. I'd tried that, and that was way too boisterous and too intrusive. I mean, people asked me a lot of questions that made me uncomfortable, like, do you have a sponsor? Do you have a home group? Do you go to a lot of meetings? Do you have a job at this meeting? Horrible questions. And don't take me there. She agreed not to do that, and I said I'd like to find Marion. And she didn't know Marion, but said if I came to AA and Marion was still there, I'd meet her sooner or later. And I had seen her the first time around, and I wanted to talk to her, but what happened was that I would see her across the room, and she just kind of radiated joy, and people clearly liked her a whole lot, and she seemed to have a sense of purpose, clearly a sense of belonging, and I was waiting for her to come over and say, Marilyn, I saw you from across the room, and I learned your name, and I'd like to get to know you, and if you're new, I'd like to be your sponsor, and if I become your sponsor, you will become my very favorite sponsee in no time, and I was waiting and waiting for that, and it never happened, so I never talked to her, So Lorena took me off to a dark, quiet meeting, and after the break, I was feeling pretty bad and wanted to get out of there. And the leader came up to the podium and said, and our main speaker tonight is Marion. And there she was, my Marion. And in my alcoholic fog, I just wondered, how can that be? How could that happen? I don't know how it could happen, to tell the truth. This program now has kept me sober for more than 36 years. I am struck with the mystery in this program. I still love science, but I have come to know that there is something very, very powerful and supernatural that acts in our fellowship, that loves us very much and wants us to be well, wants us to be what we were put on earth to be. I've come to believe that, but I surely don't understand it. Because I love science, my higher power does not violate the laws of physics and chemistry by any means. But there are an awfully lot of coincidences and things that just would not happen unless you're way out at 8 or 9 standard deviations on some kind of distribution. They happen. How does it happen? I don't know, but it doesn't violate anything. So it's very pleasing to me. And I've been really happy about that these two worlds that seemed so separate for so long came together in this fellowship. But way back there, that was just the beginning of the skeptic, the atheist, the scornful one, the sick and crazy one, sitting there thinking, wow, that is a strange coincidence. And that was entrance into that mystery. It was also entrance into the real fellowship, too, because I thought, okay, she's not going to get away this time. And I ran up to Marian and actually attached to her like a fungus on a tree. Don't go. Would you be my sponsor? And she agreed to be my sponsor if I came to her home group, the Pacific group. And I just explained, no, not that. And she explained, I can't be your sponsor then. And I stood at the turning point. I said, okay, Marian, even that. I had already attached, and I was in her power. Now, it's a funny thing. I didn't bring much into Alcoholics Anonymous, a very sick body and a very sick mind, and a whole bunch of character defects. That's about all I brought in. And I believe that this God, this higher power that I've come to know, and this fellowship uses whatever we bring in, and it's often not terribly much. I just have this vision of pushing a big wheelbarrow full of character defects right down the center aisle and hitting kind of a bump, and the thing overturns and spills all out into the center aisle, and everybody comes out and they sort through it, and we could use this. Hideous and sick parasite. Ah, yes. Uh-huh, that's good. We'll use that. That's a need for approval. Uh-huh, okay. And she'll do what her sponsor wants her to, because she's a sick and hideous parasite. Wonderful. You embezzled funds when you were a treasurer? Uh-huh, okay. We'll make you treasurer of the Monday night meeting. Good, okay. Uh-huh, that's good. And it worked. I just found that there was a very painful process, actually. Marian suggested coming to meetings early, trying to talk with other people. All I knew how to say was, hi, I am a scientist, and they'd all run away, of course. But she began to teach me these things that little children learn back in Ohio, probably in Portland, Oregon, too, how to be interested in other people. I began to learn that when I posed this question, what do you do, Marian, if somebody says, how are you? I mean, that had puzzled me all of my life. I tried to answer it, and I talked to people about depression for 15 minutes, anxiety for another 15, and they would run away in terror, of course. And I thought, I'm giving them what they ask for. What's wrong with these people? Marian, what do I say if somebody says, how are you? And she just looked at me and laughed, as she usually did when I talked to her. Most people regard that as a form of greeting. Just say, fine, how are you? And I tried it, and the other person started talking and smiling and acting like I was a human being too. And these things that Marian began to teach me, now I look back and I realize these are the simple things that happen when people get together and talk to one another. And I had absolutely no idea how to enter in. And Marian began to give me these little keys. Fine, how are you? Just ask how they're doing. And listen. Then you'll know what to say next if you listen. I had never listened before. I was just plotting what I'd say next. She gave me phrases that were helpful, like self-obsession. And that was good, because then I could name what I needed to let go of. I sat down and wrote a fearless and searching moral inventory of my mother-in-law. And she even listened to that and then directed me into what she called Marilyn's part, which was painful indeed. And meanwhile, I just realized that I am active, I'm staying sober, I'm beginning to enter into this fellowship. But the longer I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more anxious I felt. People said, you've got to write another inventory. And I would say things like, I'm too anxious to do that. And I'd say, I feel so much guilt about my children. And they would say, why don't you write an inventory? And I would explain why I couldn't do that. One day I just surrendered and said, okay, I'll write an inventory. None of these things are going to work for me, but I'll do it just to get people to stop telling me to do things that won't work. Because then I can say, see? And then they'll stop bothering me. So I began to do those things, like take the steps, volunteer for Southern California Convention, volunteer to be the coffee maker. And I still felt a lot of guilt about the children. They were afraid of many, many things. They were small when I got sober. And we began to grow up together. But I just could not let go of the guilt I felt about them. And we had moved up to San Francisco. Now, why was that a bad thing? I used to think that guilt is healthy because I am punishing myself with guilt. But my sponsor said, guilt is a selfish pastime. You should use that energy to make living amends, to try to do something constructive. As long as you sit around feeling guilty, nobody's benefiting from that. And I couldn't see it. I went to meetings and cried a lot and said, I feel so guilty. And then I'd go home, and what was happening was I thought, I have to make living amends. What I was doing was looking at our children. Oh, by the way, Marion helped me with something really, really important when I was new. And, of course, that was how to grow up and be a mom. And she said, okay, the first project is we're going to count them and just see what we're dealing with. And that was a beginning. And much to my surprise, there were only three of them. And after a while, the grandmas went home, and they said, okay, it seems like we can leave them here with her. She's shaping up. And then as years went by, I began to feel ever more guilty, and I was watching those three grow up, and they were in grade school. What happened was that they would come home from school, and I just looked at them, and I thought, it's because of my drinking that they're not quite right. And if they had happened to miss some problem on their homework paper, I'd look at that and think, it's because I drank so much. It's because I drank while I was pregnant. It's because I was a terrible mom. So I would say, okay, you have to do better. You can't go out and play. We're going to sit here and we're going to work arithmetic problems. And our son David just wanted to go out and play baseball with his friends. Becky wanted to learn how to play the guitar, and I thought, no, she must learn to play the cello, because if she becomes a great cellist, they can't believe that her mom was bad. And I won't have to feel so guilty anymore. But if she just plays the guitar, they still might think, guitars, that's associated with drinking. Rock bands, it's because of that mom. No, Becky, you can't have a guitar, but we'll buy you a cello, and you must play the cello. I don't want to play the cello. Play the cello. So anyway, this was making living amends to my children. And they were getting ever more nervous. And I thought, why is this happening? Our little son began to steal lots of things, and he was afraid of everything. And I talked to people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said, listen to him, just sit down. And get him to draw pictures and talk. And he kept stealing things. And they'd say, pray about it. And I would pray about it. And by this time, I was coming to think, maybe something's listening. Maybe. But why doesn't he stop stealing? And he didn't. And years went by. And I heard Chuck Chamberlain come around to our group and talk. And he talked about living with unresolved problems. And if you stay sober long enough, you realize that they're not even problems. That's just life. We live it, and some things are challenges and are hard, and some things are easy and they're a little bit boring, but we enjoy it all, and I listen to that. But right in those days, everything was a challenge. But I learned to live with so-called unresolved problems, and I just kind of let it go. And I stayed ever active in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor, Marion, moved away. I thought I would die over that. I told her that I can't stay sober, and she said, of course you can. I said, let me come with you. And she said, no, you're pretty intense. You've got to get a sponsor that's right here in your home group. And that dependency was broken. And I thought that I thought I would get drunk. I cried a lot over that. But what happened was that dependency then got transferred to my home group, to a whole constellation of old-timers. I've had sponsors ever since. My sponsor for the past almost 20 years has been Clancy, down in our home group. Many of you know him. He is somebody that will always be more active than I am in Alcoholics Anonymous. So he sets that wonderful example. And I've had these people in my life, but I have never, ever had that kind of dependency again after that was broken. With each one of the breaking of those ties, my higher power has transferred that dependency to a larger and larger group. So that I'm a little bit freer than I ever was before. Each day, that dependency is more and more on something that I can't even see, can't even feel, but I just know it's there and takes good care of all of us. But I've never let go of it. Those dependencies have to be wrenched away from me so that my fingernails are torn out and I am all bloody. And that's when I let go. So the children just weren't acting right, but I was living with unresolved problems. And one day David said, I'd like to learn to rock climb. And he'd seen some rock climbers on television. And I said, David, that's dangerous. And I had been a rock climber in my graduate student days. And then I started drinking a lot of beer, and I lost all my climbing partners. Well, not quite in that way. They just didn't want to climb with me anymore. But I had remembered that fondly, roping up and going up granite, and the feel of boot on granite and fingers on granite is kind of a central experience. And it was coming back to me, and I said, okay, well, we'll go to the Sierra Club because you can learn how to do that safely. And since he was so young, he was around 12 years old then, I had to go along with him because he was a minor and he couldn't engage in a dangerous sport without mom or dad being along. So we began to do that together. And I was doing things with the other offspring. And then, much to my surprise, some years went by, and David was growing into a young man, and he was beginning to climb really well, and he was taking the lead, and we began to climb together. We'd just go out and do vertical rocks. There's a lot of very nice climbing areas down in the Sierra and down near Los Angeles, in fact, and we'd been climbing out on a Memorial Day weekend, and the sun was sort of getting low in the sky, and it was kind of golden, and it was shining on the granite, and it was just as if the whole place were radiant, and David was taking the lead, and I was looking up at this young man, so confident. He had found something that he could do, and was doing it well. And I was holding a rope because he was climbing on up ahead, and you put in protection and clip your rope into that and climb a little farther when you're in the lead. But if you fall, then somebody's there, anchored in, holding onto the rope. I was belaying him. And every now and then he has kind of slipped and fallen, and I hold the rope, and then he scrambles onto the rock and goes higher up, and then anchors in, and then I climb up to that spot. And as he was climbing, and I was holding his life in my hands with that rope, I just thought, you know, When I was sitting out in the garage, they didn't even want me to come in the house because I was a real danger to those kids. And now we're out here alone on this vertical wall, and I'm holding David with this rope, and I'm paying attention. And we're having a really, really exciting good time. And then I thought, you know, it's been ever so long since he stole anything. And I just said a little prayer. Thank you for answering that prayer with such delightful finesse. My higher power has surprised me. I pray for something for a long time, and if it's one of those intractable problems, I always have to give up and just say, this is never, ever going to be solved, but I will learn to live with it, and I will do it bravely and nobly so I can set a good example in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I bear that pain and eventually forget about the pain, and then one day I'm using the past tense to somebody I sponsor, and I realize that's no longer a problem. When was that solved? I think mountain climbing had something to do with it for David, just finding that thing. What Alcoholics Anonymous was giving to me, he was finding in something that he excelled at it. And he is now, he's approaching 40 because he was born before I got sober. So my children will always be older than I. And they are certainly a lot more mature. But this has been something that has enriched his life. He does big walls in Yosemite and was part of a big half-dome project going up that vertical face. And he has a job, too, and earns a living. So that's good. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, somehow this prayer... Help me lose this guilt about my children. Help me replace it with a celebration for their lives and a forgiveness of myself. Please help me with that. Then I forgot about it because I knew I would feel guilty forever. Well, there's still some guilt, residual guilt, I suppose. But because of this total involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned to grow up with my children as I learned to grow up with newer people in Alcoholics Anonymous and have the privilege of sponsoring them, I realized that being a mom is just like being a sponsor, sharing experience, strength, and hope. And I've seen our two daughters grow up and produce four little grandsons and I missed it the first time around, but I get to see it this time and watch them say their first words and take their first steps. Their first words are always grandma. Mm-hmm. It always sounds like ga, 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 but I know what it means. And I just wondered if I'd ever go to work again. And people kept saying, well, take a job at this meeting. And I said, no, I mean, a real job. And they said, well, that's a real job. That's an important job. Make coffee at this meeting. And again, that was one where I just had to put that on the shelf. I'll never go to work again. I disgraced myself so terribly. But I was encouraged after writing inventories about squandering a lot of funds to begin to make amends for that. So the first step was just to call the director of the lab where I drank all that beer and squandered all the funds and ask to see him. And I went back and talked about being in Alcoholics Anonymous and saying how sorry I was for squandering such a wonderful opportunity. I really feel bad about that. And is there anything I can do to undo the damage that I caused? And he was terribly embarrassed, and he put his hand on the doorknob like, get out of here. This is embarrassing. And I thought, this is horrible. That's not how a man should be. And I ran screaming to old-timers, and they said, that's the first step. That's an apology, but that's just the beginning. You should feel bad. But now you can make living amends. And I said, I don't have a job. I don't know how to make living amends. And they said, well, do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous and do it well. And years went by. I don't know how many. But one day that director called and offered me a job. Now, how did that happen? I have no idea. What was he thinking? But I did go back to work in the lab, and And I was talking with Chris and Barbara and Joe. We were just reminiscing about how things do not always work out the way we think they might. I sort of think ahead, and I think it's all going to work out. It's got to work out so that it makes a good podium story. So I knew that I would win the Nobel Prize once I went back to that lab. But much to my great disappointment, not only did I not win the Nobel Prize, I couldn't even do laboratory work. I still broke things and spilled things and even exploded things. And it was not supposed to happen that way. Other people encouraged me to find another line of work. And luckily, it was a scientific lab, and so I began to organize information and help with paper writing and grant proposal writing, and I became a grant proposal writer, so I could still be near science, and actually went back to school and got a degree in library and information science, where I don't blow up things anymore. And there's, except for the information explosion, which is perfectly safe, more or less. I've enjoyed working ever since because Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to work. And somehow, because of the perspective that has been superimposed on me in this fellowship, I didn't have to retire to the cold room and drink myself to death just because things didn't work out. I realized that I'm not cut out to do so-called wet science, research in a lab, because I can't do it. It just does not work out for me. But there are many, many other things that I can do, that we all seem to be put here on Earth to do something that's unique. We're all different. I've been thinking about Chuck Chamberlain tonight, but he used to say we should never compare ourselves with any other person because each one of us is put here to do something special. And we have to find what that is and do it to the best of our ability. There were other things that I could do, and because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was urged, forced to look for that other thing and found my thing. And I've heard that time and time again in this fellowship. One of the sweetest things that happened to me was that I one day looked and saw that Bill took off his lab coat. And I no longer saw him as Bill the scientist, but just plain Bill, this dear, sweet man that was so tolerant. And I am embarrassed to say that when I first got sober, I told Marion, I have to get a divorce because I don't even know this man. I haven't talked to him for years, and it's immoral to stay in this house, and I don't even know him. I certainly don't love him. I've got to leave. And she said, now, what you're saying to me is, you want to leave this good man that protected the children and took care of you and stood by you when you were so sick and so crazy all those years, and now that you're starting to recover, you want to walk out on this family and this good man that did that. That's what you're saying to me. Is that right? And I said, no, I don't think I'm saying that. But that's exactly what I was saying. And thank God that I could hear my sponsor and do things that just didn't seem right. I stayed there. I stayed there because I was told to do it, and I was told how to act. Instead of saying, well, grabbing his lapels and screaming, you make me miserable because you don't love me enough and you've been so mean to me. Communication. Instead of doing that, I did what Marion suggested, which was to say things like, what would you like for dinner, honey? How was your day, sweetie? Things that I'd never said. And years went by, and we began to find that we have these things in common, like music and the children and cats and Gary Larson and funny movies and more things. And if we both live to the 31st of August, which is coming right up, we'll celebrate 50 years together. So, but that is not all. We pass for normal. And yes. But I just thought, as the years went by, and I began to appreciate the goodness of Bill and to recognize the great good fortune to have such a good person in my life, a constant presence all of these years, where we can grow old together and realize that those wedding vows really are like Alcoholics Anonymous. Love is not attachment like tick on dog. It is being here for one another as we are in the fellowship, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health. We hope until death do us part. And there was a poet, Browning, I think, that said, what I've come to know in Alcoholics Anonymous, grow old along with me. The best is yet to be, the last of life, for which the first was made. Thank you.